I want to talk today about something very difficult to do. Something so difficult that some of you may not even dare to attempt it. It's okay. I'm not judging. I'm sure you've thought about it, attempted it. Maybe even you've put enough practice into it so that you're very good. And, well, that's good. But I'm sure that no matter how much you have practiced, you still slip up. What is this difficult feat of athleticism that I'm talking about? Washing your feet while standing in the shower. That's not very easy, as you might guess. And it's even harder as you get older. First, it involves standing on one foot. Most of you, I think, can do that. Some of you may struggle. This alone is not generally too difficult if you're standing on a stable surface, wearing good footwear, and you have the rest of your body parts to modulate your balance. But washing your feet in the shower adds several layers of complexity and challenges above and beyond just standing on one foot. First, let's take away your shoes so you only have the surface of your skin to rely on to keep you stable on the ground. Then you'll need to stand on that one bare foot on a wet, slick surface. And if that's not enough of a hazard, we'll add a little bit of soap to make it super slippery on that wet, slick surface. Now, once you're in that position, standing on one foot on a wet, slick, soapy surface, you'll need to hold it there for a minute or so. And while you do, bend down far enough in a crouching position so that you can lift your other foot up high enough so that you can scrub that foot with your hands. Okay, not now, I'm sorry. Hold that position and concentrate not only on scrubbing in between each one of your toes and the sole of your foot, but also focus on keeping your balance. It's very easy, by the way, to lose your balance and fall to your doom. Maybe not that dramatic, but it is slippery. I'm sure that many of you, like me, trying to do this, have slipped and had to catch yourself. Now, maintaining this balance needed to wash your feet while standing in the shower is so difficult that I'm pretty confident that there are a lot of you out there who've come up with alternative ways to completely avoid it, whether sitting or crouching or whatever. And that's okay. Like I said, I'm not judging. It doesn't matter if you wash your foot while standing or sitting down, as long as you do it, in and out, now and then. It's far more important that you focus on something much more difficult in your practice of balance, and that is that you invest your energy and your resources in practicing how to live a balanced life in all things. We can talk about living a balanced life and generally knowing what that looks like. It's characterized by moderation, governing the amount of time and resources that we invest in our activities, making sure that we don't spend too much or too little doing this or that, making sure that we are doing the right things. But this ideal of living a balanced life begs some very important questions. Just saying, do the right things with just the right amount of time and investment of your resources, it's not very helpful. How are we to know how much is too much? How much is too little? How do we know if we're putting our effort into endeavors that are the right things? How do we know if we are well-balanced or not? How do we know if we're completely misguided, doing the wrong things but spending the right amount of time doing them, so to speak? If we want to maintain a balanced life, striving towards that ideal, how can we calibrate? How can we determine if we are truly living a balanced life? These are the questions that I would like to investigate with you today. Maintaining balance is the title of my sermon today, and it is a struggle that we need to all continually work to understand in order to practice and do. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 3 for our first scripture today. This passage talks about balance in many aspects. Ecclesiastes 3, and I'm beginning in verse 1. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace. We have so many examples here that oppose one another. To do the right thing, depending on the timing and the context of a situation, is the definition of balance. Depending on the circumstances, it is best to do one thing, and in other circumstances, it's best to do the exact opposite. But how do you know? How do you know if it's time to break down? How do you know if it's time to build up? How do you know if it's time to love or to hate? If we make the wrong judgment, the outcome of that judgment will not be what we want to have. That outcome is truly what we need to focus on when we are making our judgments. For example, let's say that we are running a business and hit a hard time. We would be in a position of risk. If we do nothing, that's a problem. Would it be a time to break down that business, to prevent the inevitable failure and collapse and further problems? Or is it time to push harder and try something else and build up? How do you know? Making the wrong decision will lead to an unfavorable outcome. And there's no way to tell ahead of time what that outcome will be. Balanced decision making and action requires of us that we have a reliable way of evaluating our circumstances, a reliable way of making decisions, and a reliable way of taking actions based on those decisions. If we want to know how to judge our circumstances properly, we need to look at the source from which we draw to evaluate, decide, and act. That source that we draw from to do those things truly matters. If our source is poisoned by pride, it will lead to an outcome that is not balanced and does damage that we do not want. The outcome of that, of operating from that poisoned source, will be weighted more heavily towards feeding self-interest, which is ugly. The outcome of feeding self-interest is not balanced. But if the source that we draw from to make our judgments is pure, the outcome will produce the fruit that naturally grows from those values at the source of our judgment, the pure, godly, virtuous values. It will take all of the important aspects that we hold into consideration: love for others, love for God, and obedience to Him. The results will not be weighted too heavily in one way or another, because when we draw from a godly source, from His truth, and act in accordance with that, the outcome is always balanced. Sounds great. It really does. All we need to do then is draw from the right source in evaluating, deciding, and doing, and everything is beautifully balanced. That's the ideal. Sounds easy, but hey, it can get pretty messy. Because the response that we get from acting from that true, good, godly source, even when we are balanced, it gives us yet another challenge to evaluate because there are results that naturally flow from that. Sometimes those results are still difficult circumstances. Balancing takes continual practice, doing, checking, acting, in a constant cycle. I'd like to read Proverbs 26 and verse 4 through 5. Proverbs 26, verses 4 through 5. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you be like him. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own eyes. I thought I was good here. What am I supposed to do? We have the same kind of situation, right, in which we are told how and when to answer a fool according to his folly. Sometimes to do nothing, sometimes to do the exact opposite. Here we have this nice, clear set of instructions from the Bible, don't we? Even though it seems contradictory and ambiguous, if we read a little bit more closely, it really does help to guide us. This explains that we need to evaluate our situation before we make a judgment. We are instructed to balance the effect of our actions upon ourselves and upon the fool. Consider both when we make our judgment. As we know, some arguments are really not worth having because they lead to nothing. It's just arguing for argument's sake. That is when it is not worth answering a fool to his own folly. But at other times, it is worth investing our effort because it leads to correction and edification and growth. To understand that context of that situation, we need to truly consider what the inevitable outcome will be if we answer the fool. This prompts us to ask ourselves, which is always an important question, why am I making this decision to do this thing I'm about to do? That question of why is critical as we learn how to balance. That question, why am I taking this action, will give us an answer of whether we are making a decision for the right reasons or not. If I am choosing to answer a fool to his folly so that I can prove myself as being right and him wrong, that's not the right reason. But if I choose to answer a fool because I feel that I can convey the truth, and that truth is important to express for the sake of the truth, that's a different reason, right? Why are we answering? Why are we doing the things that we do? I'd like to look at some examples today. I've got a bunch that I want to go through. I would like to begin with some examples of Jesus Christ. Let's turn over to Mark 11, and I'm going to read beginning in verse 15. Jesus Christ, as we know, led a perfectly balanced life. Mark 11 and verse 15. So they came to Jerusalem. Then Jesus went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple. Then he taught them, saying, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you have made it a den of thieves?" And the scribes and chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him, for they feared him, because all the people were astonished at his teaching. Jesus Christ came down very strongly, even with physical force, in this act of correction. He needed to express deep anger about what was happening in the temple. He wasn't doing this out of self-interest. In this instance, Jesus needed to express his righteous anger about what was happening because this correction was necessary to be very visible and very strong. His judgment at that point in time led him to take this very dramatic action. What was the outcome? Jesus Christ was able to evaluate his situation, make his decisions, because he knew that the outcome would lead to what we read here. The people were astonished at his teaching. They realized their eyes were opened, which is a very good thing. What was the other outcome that is a little bit messy that Jesus Christ also needed to deal with? And that is that the scribes and chief priests, they wanted to destroy him. Okay, that's the consequence. Sometimes making a balanced decision does not all turn out to be rainbows and sunshine. Sometimes it turns out to be yet more difficult circumstances to balance. But this was a balanced decision and course of action because it came from a pure source. Jesus Christ was taking this action because he wanted to glorify God. He wasn't looking to glorify himself. So he was willing to deal with whatever consequences came from that. As we see here, some were great. They were astonished. Yet some were even more challenging that he had to deal with. But he was okay with that because he knew it was right. Let's go to Matthew 23, and I'll read verses 13 through 15. Here again, we see an example of Jesus Christ expressing strong language directed towards the Pharisees. Matthew 23, beginning in verse 13. "But woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you shut up the kingdom of heaven against men, for you neither go in yourselves, nor do you allow those who are entering to go in. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you devour widows' houses, and for a pretense make long prayers. Therefore you will receive greater condemnation. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you travel land and sea to win one proselyte, and when he is won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves." Going down to verse 23, he continues, "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faith. These you ought to have done without leaving the others undone. Blind guides who strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! For you cleanse the outside of a cup and dish, but inside they are full of extortion and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first cleanse the inside of the cup and dish, that the outside of them may be clean also." It doesn't stop here. "Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you are like whitewashed tombs, which inside appear beautiful outwardly, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but inside are full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness." Again, we see very strong condemnation of the so-called righteous scribes and Pharisees here. Interestingly here, Jesus Christ is pointing out how unbalanced these individuals are. They, for an image, appear to be righteous, but in practice, they are not living in a righteous way, because it is not coming from the right source. The source of their righteousness is for self-aggrandizement. They are looking to elevate themselves to appear righteous outwardly, so they get the praise of men. They are not glorifying God from their heart in what they are doing. And Jesus Christ, again here, I'm looking at his example of being balanced. Why did he do it this way? He could have kept his peace and seek his own self-preservation instead of making enemies, not drawing attention to himself. If he had not made so many enemies, maybe it would have been easier for him to preach to those who would actually listen. Wasn't he there to perform his ministry, to preach the word to people who would actually hear him? Would he have been able to do more preaching if he didn't make these enemies who wanted to kill him and actually did? Well, that's not what Jesus Christ was here to do. He was here to do something far greater, and he knew what he was doing. He knew that it was necessary to have this strong, outward, open confrontation and condemnation of this behavior. It would have been unbalanced for him to do the opposite, for him to keep to himself, because his reasons would not have been derived from a desire to glorify God, but rather he would have been perhaps motivated out of fear if he hadn't said these things. Seeking his own self-preservation, that is not balanced. Now let's compare this strong condemnation, these strong outward examples, to points in time when Jesus Christ chose to be merciful. Let's look at John 8 and read verses 2 through 11. John 8 and verse 2, we read about a woman who is caught in adultery. Now early in the morning, he came again into the temple, and all the people came to him, and he sat down and taught them. Then the scribes and Pharisees brought to him a woman caught in adultery. And when they had set her in the midst, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in adultery in the very act. Now Moses in the law commanded us that such should be stoned. But what do you say?" This they said, testing him, that they might have something of which to accuse him. But Jesus stooped down and wrote on the ground with his finger, as though he did not hear. So when they continued asking him, he raised himself up and said to them, "He who is without sin among you, let him throw a stone at her first." And again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. Then those who heard it, being convicted by their conscience, went out one by one, beginning with the oldest, even to the last. And Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst. When Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, "Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, Lord." And Jesus said to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." This example appears to stand in stark contrast to the strong condemnation Jesus brought to the scribes and Pharisees in the previous examples. In this example, Jesus emphasizes mercy because it produced the right effect in everyone. Everyone there appeared to see the sin in their own lives, felt convicted by their conscience, perhaps remorseful, and we can presume that they started their path to repentance. That is the kind of outcome Jesus knew would happen if he offered a merciful approach. Jesus evaluated the circumstances and chose to act in the way that he did to produce the right outcome. And he knew that this was the right thing to do because he was motivated by his purpose to serve God and not to appease these men and fall into their trap that they were laying for him. They wanted him to break the law, right? They wanted to have something against him, but he knew how to get through that because he had a balanced approach. Let's go back to Luke chapter 7. And I'd like to read verses 36 through 47. Here we see another example of Jesus Christ being merciful. Luke chapter 7 and verse 36. Then one of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him. And he went to the Pharisee's house and sat down to eat. And behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil and stood at his feet behind him weeping. And she began to wash his feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with fragrant oil. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he spoke to himself, saying, "This man, if he were a prophet, he would know who and what manner of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Simon, I have something to say to you." So he said, "Teacher, say it." There was a certain creditor who had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii and the other 50. And when they had nothing with which to repay, he freely forgave them both. "Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him more?" Simon answered and said, "I suppose the one whom he forgave more." And he said to him, "You have rightly judged." Then he turned to the woman and said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has washed my feet with her tears and wiped them with the hair of her head. You gave me no kiss, but this woman has not ceased to kiss my feet since the time I came in. You did not anoint my head with oil, but this woman has anointed my feet with fragrant oil. Therefore I say to you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven, for she loved much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loves little." This is another example of Jesus Christ's mercy. He could have very easily condemned this woman for her sin. She was a sinner, right? But he didn't, because it was not the right response here. Rather than come down strongly on her, he acknowledges her repentance and her love, forgives her, because that is what was proper at that point in time. That is what led her to forgiveness. In doing so, he teaches a lesson of balance to the Pharisee as well. People are complex beings. Sometimes we need to interact differently depending upon the circumstances that we have. With the discipline of children, sometimes it is important that we rule with a rod of iron to get the point across. And sometimes we get more response, a better response, corrective response, when we express disappointment. Simply with words to help them understand errors. In both, the goal is to correct paths so that it leads to the right behavior. Choosing the right kind of action takes discernment. It's not easy. But Jesus Christ gives us an example to follow. I'd like to read a couple other examples. Going over to Galatians 2, if you'll turn there with me, I'll read verses 11 through 14. I have just a pair of examples about Paul and how he dealt with his situations, a couple of them. Galatians 2 and verse 11. Now when Peter had come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed. For before certain men came from James, he would eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision. And the rest of the Jews also played the hypocrite with him, so that even Barnabas was carried away with their hypocrisy. But when I saw that they were not straightforward about the truth of the gospel, I said to Peter before them all, if you, being a Jew, live in the manner of Gentiles and not as the Jews, why do you compel the Gentiles to live as Jews? Paul rebukes Peter for the way that he was appeasing the Jews by not eating with the Gentiles in their presence. Peter didn't want to cause offense, but his motivation was from the wrong source. And Paul calls him out on that. Peter didn't want to be judged by the Jews. He didn't think that it was, he believed that by eating with the Gentiles, if the Jews saw that, it would become a stumbling block. But he was totally incorrect. It caused a stumbling block instead. It caused further wrong behavior because it separated the Jews and the Gentiles when they were supposed to have unity. Peter was motivated by self-interest. It was just in a disguise of doing the work. And that is a very tricky trap to detect. Sometimes we may think we are choosing to do what is right and good because it appears to be that way. But when we go back and ask that question, why am I doing this? Why? We may find that there is a seed of self-interest, self-preservation, instead of godly motivation. Paul, here, he corrects Peter to help him regain his balance. I'd like to read another example in which Paul offers guidance to one of those in the ministry. And this is in Acts 16, when he's working with Timothy. Acts 16, I'm reading verses 1 through 5. Then he came to Derbe and Lystra. And behold, a certain disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a certain Jewish woman who believed, but his father was Greek. He was well spoken of by the brethren who were at Lystra and Iconium. Paul wanted to have him go on with him. And he took him and circumcised him because of the Jews who were in that region. For they all knew that his father was a Greek. And as they went through the cities, they delivered to them the decrees to keep, which were determined by the apostles and elders at Jerusalem. So the churches were strengthened in the faith and increased in number daily. Here we see a pretty interesting example that seems to contradict what we read before when Paul was working with Peter. Here we see Paul instruct Timothy to become circumcised, right? Even though it was not necessary to do, he believed that it would have been a stumbling block in Timothy's ministry if he did not get circumcised. Because he would be going to the Jews, he needed them to have respect. In both cases, the one with Peter and with Timothy, Paul seeks balance by finding the right way to prevent stumbling blocks for the purpose of the ministry that he was leading. It takes discernment and balance to figure out from the context what is the right thing to do. They appear to be contradictory examples, in one condemning the appeasement of the Jews and in another requiring their appeasement. But the reason behind these judgments comes from the same source, and that is to do the work of God effectively. Walking that high wire takes balance. And Paul's examples highlight that here. To live a balanced life, then, involves fundamentally learning how to make the right judgment about your situation. How do we make sure our evaluation comes from the right place? Jesus Christ had the perfect balanced approach in his life because he was able to use the Holy Spirit to make that discernment. Paul was doing the same thing in the examples that we read. And we, too, have to do the same thing in our lives. To live a balanced life means to evaluate our circumstances in life in the same way that God evaluates our circumstances in life. And there's only one way to do that. And that is with the Holy Spirit. We need to live and walk in the Spirit, being guided by the Spirit, seeking to bear the fruit of the Spirit as an outcome. That is our motivation. This is how we make the right judgment about how to understand our circumstances. This is how we can decide what is the right thing to do. So then, balance begins with living according to the Spirit, working from those values as our source of judgment in all things. Let's turn to Galatians 5 and read about walking in the Spirit. Galatians 5, beginning in verse 16. I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the lust of the flesh, for the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. This is what it takes to be balanced. Doing the things that we do not wish is the symptom of an unbalanced life. That's how we can tell if we're unbalanced. If we realize that we are sinning, if we are doing something that is just not right, I wish I hadn't done that, right? If we have regrets, that's a hint that we are not walking by the Spirit. The prescription we have which alleviates that symptom is to walk in the Spirit, to be motivated by those things that the Spirit bears fruit of. Going down to Galatians 5, verse 22, we read about the fruit of the Spirit. These are the things we should be seeking out in our lives. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law, and those who are Christ's have crucified the flesh with its passions and desires. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Balance produces these exact things. If we are asking ourselves why we are choosing to do something, we should be able to analyze the outcome that we are really after. Are we really seeking peace? Is there any hint that corrupts that? Am I saying that I seek peace and instead actually just seeking my own self-glory in being the peacemaker? There's a big difference, right? The fruit of the Spirit is selfless. The fruit of the Spirit describes the outcome from living a balanced life, and walking in the Spirit is the way to achieve that outcome. It's the only way to achieve that outcome. And that means embedding godly discernment into the whole process of our life. In every aspect, we ought to operate with the fruit of the Spirit as our motivation. When we evaluate our circumstances, our godly discernment needs to be in place. When we make decisions about what to do, godly discernment needs to be in place. When we take actions upon those actions need to be motivated by developing and producing the fruit of the Spirit that we read about here. That is walking in the Spirit. It's thinking, deciding, and doing. All of that from that spiritual perspective. Romans 8, verses 4 through 6, elaborate upon this. Romans 8 and verse 4 breaks in here. That the righteous requirement of the law may be fulfilled in us, who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Being spiritually minded helps us to remove the corruption of carnal self-interest from our discernment. And doing so eliminates the imbalance that finds its end in death. On the contrary, when we are able to discern our circumstances and make decisions and take actions from being spiritually minded, it leads to a balanced result. And what is that? We read it right here. It's life. It's peace. When we feel peace, that is what balance in a life feels like. We don't have conflict in peace. When there's no conflict, we have balance and harmony. That is the fruit of the Spirit that comes from a balanced life. Godly motivation is where we need to draw from for our source of understanding our lives and making decisions. Because if we rely on ourselves, we're doomed. I'll read Jeremiah 17, verses 9 and 10. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the mind, even to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. It is so very easy to become self-deceived. Think about Peter for an example. He was really trying to do what was right. But boy, the heart is deceitful above all things. It's so human to be misguided. Sometimes we may, like Peter, think that we have a virtuous reason for doing the things that we do. Serving God, I'm doing this the right way, right? But in reality, we are actually serving ourselves, being misguided, being off balance, directed by a carnal heart, carnal motivations. And I really feel that this is at the root of the problem of imbalance. What are we to do about it? Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6 tell us exactly what to do. Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he shall direct your paths. By embedding our trust in God in our lives, we don't have to worry about the failures of our own flawed human judgment. We have Him to direct our paths. We have no regrets if we are able to truly let God direct our paths, because we know He's in control. And God is the master of balance. I'd like to read some examples of those who did a good job and some of those who didn't do a good job of walking according to the Spirit. Saul is an example. God instructed Saul at one point when he was king to destroy the Amalekites, utterly, leaving nothing alive, leaving nothing behind. However, Saul did not follow this instruction, but he decided to keep the good stuff. Why destroy all this stuff? I could still use it. And then he justified that by making a sacrifice of those good things, thinking, I'll please God and show Him that I'm doing something that serves Him. If you turn with me to 1 Samuel 15, we can read about the outcome of that. 1 Samuel 15, verses 22 and 23, is where we see Samuel confront Saul on this matter. 1 Samuel 15 and verse 22. So Samuel said, "Has the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, He also has rejected you from being king." And Saul said to Samuel, "I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandments of the Lord and your words," which is true, "because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord." But Samuel said to Saul, "I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel." We can see Saul's error here in the light of day. He acknowledges his fault, but that he did not obey the instruction of God. Then he makes an excuse, states that he feared the people as the reason for his error. "I listened to them. They told me to do it." Still not admitting that he had his own fault in the matter. He was the leader. He was the king, right? He was in control. He was deceived in his own heart, not balanced by living according to the Spirit of God. He was serving himself, following his own heart. Moses gives us another example. This is in Numbers 20, verses 10 through 12. Israel is on their journey, departing from in the wilderness, rather, and they're upset because they want water. And what does Moses do? Numbers 20 and verse 10. "And Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, 'Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?' Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, 'Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them.'" What happened here? What happened? Well, Moses did not follow the instruction of God in how to draw water from this rock. This is the second point in time that Moses did draw water from that rock. Previous example, which I won't go to, Moses was instructed to strike the rock to bring forth water. But in this instance, God instructs him to speak to the rock. But what does he do instead? In this case, he struck the rock again out of anger, not obeying God. And it did bring forth the water, but what was the result? in acting out of his anger, wanting to show Israel that he was in control, he is not hallowing God in this example. It worked, but the result reaped the consequence that he angered God so much that he was not able to go into the promised land because he disobeyed here. Unfortunately, he slipped up in this moment, lost his balance because he was not motivated from the right source. Let's look at a couple of good examples. I'd like to go to Joshua 14 and read about Caleb. Caleb was one of those Israelites who was with Joshua. They were on their way to the promised land. Israel was there to scope out the land. Caleb was among them. As we read in Joshua 14, beginning in verse 6, "Then the children of Judah came to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephthah, the Kenizzite, said to him, 'You know the word which the Lord said to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought back word to him as it was in my heart. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt. But I wholly followed the Lord, my God. So Moses swore on that day, saying, "Surely the land where your foot has trodden shall be your inheritance and your children's forever, because you have wholly followed the Lord, my God." When the Israelites were instructed to go into the land of Canaan and scope it out, Caleb and Joshua were the only ones who returned with a good report, because they were judging in the right way. They were making a judgment about the goodness of the land and the plan to go into Canaan from a godly perspective. They were not motivated by their human fear like the other Israelites were. The other Israelites were afraid. They said the land was great, but oh boy, the people who are there, I don't want to go in there. That's not the right place to go. Right? They were trying to convince everybody to not go into this promised land. But Caleb, as we read here, followed God fully. He put away his human fear and the corruption that comes from a human heart. He reported what he saw from that source of motivation, that pure source. Paul also is a great example, who was able to live and walk in the Spirit. I'm going over to Acts 16, and I'll read verses 6 through 10. Acts 16 and verse 6. "Now when they had gone through Phrygia and the region of Galatia, they were forbidden by the Holy Spirit to preach the word in Asia. After they had come to Mysia, they tried to go into Bithynia, but the Spirit did not permit them. So passing by Mysia, they came down to Troas, and a vision appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia stood and pleaded with him, saying, 'Come over to Macedonia and help us.' Now after he had seen the vision, immediately we sought to go to Macedonia, concluding that the Lord had called us to preach the gospel to them." I really like this example because Paul obviously was hitting some friction in doing the work of God. He didn't force it. Think about another example. I'm thinking about how Abraham, he knew that he was supposed to be the father of so many children, as many as the sands on the beach, right, and stars in the sky. And he became impatient. He, too, found friction. And he took matters into his own hands, and that was the wrong thing to do. But Paul here didn't force it when he realized that what he was trying to do to preach the do his ministry was not bearing fruit. There's a time to break down sometimes, isn't there? But Paul trusts God and changes direction, and it does bear fruit. He really sought his direction, followed the Spirit, and it allowed him to do a work in Macedonia, and he was successful in doing that. So we can see from what we've learned that living in a balanced way requires that the Holy Spirit guides us. But how can we tell if we're on track? As we read, the heart is deceitful, so we can't judge by ourselves. Our incentives will expose our motivation. When we ask why we are choosing to do something, why we are judging a situation and we do, it exposes our incentives. And this is how we will be able to tell if we are balanced or not. The examples we've seen expose an incentive that is either from self-interest, either from self-preservation or fear and the negative consequences or the negative situations. Or in the positive examples, we can see an incentive to serve God, to have mercy, to show love, to bear fruit of the Spirit, to show obedience and love of God. It can be hard as Christians to rightly divide our incentives because they tend to be intermingled. I'm a Christian. It's so important for me to be Christian that I'm going to act and behave in a way that is Christian. And sometimes that can become an end in itself, Pharisaical, if you will. The Pharisees wanted to be seen as righteous rather than do what was righteous for righteousness' sake. It's tricky to balance. Again, Peter, I hate to pick on Peter so much, but it's so easy. Going over to John 13, we see the example of Peter during that foot washing ceremony and how he responds. John 13, and I'm reading verses 6 through 10. Then he, Jesus, came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, "Lord, are you washing my feet?" Jesus answered and said to him, "What I am doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this." Peter said to him, "You shall never wash my feet." Jesus answered him, "If I do not wash you, you have no part with me." Simon Peter said to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but my hands and my head." And Jesus said to him, "He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean. And you are clean, but not all of you." Peter was here with Jesus and went so far as to rebuke him for washing his feet and then ask for him to wash him completely, really missing the point. Peter really desperately wanted to serve Jesus Christ, but his motivation was not from a source of balance. His incentives were misguided. He was a diligent servant of Jesus, and he had his identity wrapped up in that. But he did not understand the relationship that Jesus Christ had with him at that point. Jesus Christ was teaching him how he was serving Peter and others, and how that example of service was a model for him to follow, to serve others. Peter learned that as we go. I'd like to go to 2 Timothy chapter 4, reading verses 2 through 4. Again, being a Christian is hard because we really do try our best to do what's right, live as Christians, behave as Christians, seek the truth. But we need to do that for the right reasons. 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 2. Preach the word, be ready in season and out of season. Convince, rebuke, exhort with all long suffering and teaching. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. Like Peter, we Christians can have, or we do have an identity in which we want to serve God, serve Jesus Christ, do what is right and good, learn, grow. That desire can become corrupted and thrown off balance when our incentive is derived from self-seeking, from getting our pet doctrines elevated, from being the one who is right, right? If we are motivated to be right, that's from the wrong source. If we are seeking the truth to learn the truth, that is the right thing. When we are corrupt in our motivations, the result can turn into an imbalance. And it, as we read here, that can go so far as to reject sound doctrine. So what's the answer? How can we evaluate our incentives? The fruit of the Spirit tells us that love is one of the products of a balanced life. Going and reading from 1 Corinthians 13, verses 4 through 7, we read about love. Love is a great answer. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love is balance. Love is the antidote to the poison that corrupts the incentives of a misguided heart, a human heart. Love for others and love for God helps us get out of the way for God to keep us in balance. The result that comes from love is peace and balance in a selfless way. Living a balanced life requires that we answer the question of why we are doing the things that we do. Are we evaluating, deciding, and acting out of self-interest, even if that interest is to build up our identity as being good Christians? If so, this will lead us to an imbalance because we are not letting God lead our judgment. When we take the lead from Him in judging, it causes corruption, resulting in imbalance. We don't produce the fruit of the Spirit living that way. But when we judge and respond to circumstances from an incentive for the love of God through obedience and the love of others to give them their benefit, this places God's judgment in the lead, bringing us into balance.